Benarg this, which is welcome in Cornish. Cornish. I'm getting into some pretty interesting languages here. So welcome to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. My name is Tim Wheaton. I am the creator and host of the podcast. And I'm really excited to bring this second episode to you with the fantastic Matt Thorne, an esteemed author and critic from across the pond in England, who has written a number of novels for adults and three books for kids as well. He's also been a film critic and a book reviewer and also doing reviews of television programs for, as he put it, almost all of the newspapers in England. So he has really been doing quite a variety of writing over the course of his lifetime. And we go into that in this episode, where he kind of got that start. I mean, he could probably know from when he was a youngster in Bristol, when he was spending so much time writing instead of doing some of the other things that some of the other kids may have been doing, and actually doing things very similar to how I was doing them when I was a kid. I remember a summer when I spent almost an entire summer in my room writing a book. And I remember my brother thinking I was absolutely crazy and probably worrying about me because I wasn't going to the beach every day, which we would normally have been doing. But instead, I was just sitting in there and writing. And so I'm really found a very cool connection with Matt as we talked about all of his time as a youth. And it got into some emotional stuff here for me, too, thinking about how his dad and his relationship was and how his dad had to work around certain life experiences to continue to parent Matt and his sister in their young and not even teenage years throughout. So very interesting conversation here that really touches on a lot of things about being a parent, being a dad, and being a son. So let's get right into it. Here is my daddy conversation with Matt Thorne. So here we are with Matt Thorne for this episode of Daddy Unscripted. Matt is an author and a critic who is across the pond, as they would say, in the United Kingdom. And Matt is an author of three children's books, six novels for the grown-ups, and as well as a critic. Do you do most of your critic work? Is that online on different sites, or is it print as well?
Yeah, it's for print and for radio. I do reviews for various newspapers. In fact, most of the British newspapers I've reviewed for at one time or other. And I also do reviews for Radio 4 over here, one of the big radio stations. I review films and books and TV programs and whatever they ask me to review.
Oh, cool. You are basically British dream me, in a way. Is that weird? That nice might be the weirdest thing somebody said to you.
Not at all. No, it's nice to hear. Thank you.
That's fantastic. So you can find Matt on Twitter. We'll say this at the end again, but if you want to like pause this recording and do a little quick research on Twitter, he is 8 minutes idle. That's the number 8. Minutes Idle, and you can see some of his stuff on there, as well as be able to catch links to some of the things that he is doing and has done in the past as well. But Matt, thank you very much for taking some time out of your weekend.
No problem. I'm very much looking forward to it.
So you have two children, yes?
That's right. Yeah, two boys.
Okay.
The one thing I would say I think is maybe interesting is that I have a sister and my wife has a brother. And neither of us have siblings of the same sex. So I don't know what it's like to have a brother. You know, I've never had a brother. Mm-hmm. And it was quite interesting to me. I always thought I would have, for some reason, I thought I would have daughters, would have girls. So it was quite a surprise to me to have two boys. But I do absolutely love it. And I do, and it's very interesting. But it's a whole dynamic I didn't see. You know, I know how brothers and sisters behave together. And I know how it feels to be an older sibling. But when I look at my young son and I look at the way that he behaves with his older sibling, I just see that that's a completely different worldview, you know, and I kind of see how, why other people behave. I understand other people a lot more now, I think, when I find out that they're either the youngest child or the oldest child. Because I just think being the youngest child, you're constantly fighting, you know, like for everything, you know. I mean, not our love, not the parents' love and attention, but just, you know, you have a sense that your brother, the reality, your brother's always there to sort of elbow you out of the way or eat your food or make you do that. You know, it's sort of, it's something that I didn't, you know, didn't really experience until I had children.
That is interesting. I think there's something to that. And I think a lot of times we don't really think about that very much when we are dealing with other adults, but knowing, and obviously it's a generalization of sorts potentially that you're getting into, but knowing what somebody else's sibling background is might be a very good insight for us to understanding how somebody can potentially react to certain things based upon from their childhood.
Absolutely. And I do think sort of having a sibling of the same sex sort of helps you in lots of ways as well. I mean, I think it sort of gives you a way of behaving with other men. You know, it's sort of, it's something that you don't necessarily get just from your dad, you know, or just from your friends, you know, the process of living in a house with another guy. And that sort of behavior is quite, you know, watching my sons sort of amuse each other and that kind of humor, you know, and it's sort of something that I've seen from other, you know, other people and adults, you know, and kind of realize that's something that I kind of missed out on in a way, you know, it's not something that I experienced.
Yeah. So let's go back first into your family and parental history. And like I always say, if that means going back to your grandfather or great-grandfather or whatnot, have at it. But tell us a little bit about the history of your dad.
Okay, well, I'm not from noble stock at all. You know, I really...
you just sound it.
It's only the accent, you know, it's not the reality. I don't really know. I mean, I haven't really gone into the genealogy of it particularly because my dad is absolutely adamantly not interested in genealogy. It's something he's in his 70s now, and he's just turned 70, and he's got other relations and friends who, you know, who get into genealogy when they retire, and he really hates it. You know, it's just something he's not interested in. But the only thing I've really got out of him is that we started out as a family coming from Goat Alley, which was the one of the roughest streets in Bristol in the West Country, where I'm from originally. And I don't know whether you had to have a goat to live there or whether, you know, there was a goat that lived there, whatever there was, but it was a synonym for rough life, you know, rough living. So I'm two or three generations back, I'm from Goat Alley. But my dad's dad was quite interesting. He was an engineer, and he was in the papers a lot recently. I mean, he died a long time ago, but they released some health and safety photographs of times gone by when there wasn't really any health or safety. And there are pictures of him on the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which was one of his embarred Kingdom Brunel, the great engineer, one of his big suspension bridges in Bristol. And my grandfather put the lights on that bridge. And there was this picture. It was on the front of all the newspapers on the same day, because they just released all these, but they found all these pictures in the archive. And it was my grandfather sitting on top of a bridge, you know, hundreds of miles in the air, with a pint of beer in one hand, a cigarette in the other, a sandwich in front of him, no harness or safety net or anything that you would expect. And they were like, how things have changed in the last, you know, 100 years or whatever, you know. So that was his big claim to fame, was that he put lights on the Clifton Suspension Bridge.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, and I got on really well with my grandfather. He was quite a difficult character in lots of ways, because his wife died when my father was 12. And he was a real romantic, and he had this thing that he said he wouldn't go out with anyone else because he only wanted one woman waiting for him in heaven. And you know, he was quite a, you know, romantic guy, but he was also quite a hard guy. You know, he drank a lot and he smoked a lot and was quite tough and not particularly loving. And I think my dad had quite a hard time with him. But then when I was a kid, I used to go and stay with him. When I was ill from school, I'd go and stay with him, and he would go to the library. He had a very sort of regimented day. He'd go to the library and he'd buy a lot of crime thrillers, and then he'd come back and he'd watch daytime TV. There was a daytime television show called Crown Court, which was a bit like televised trials, except it was fictionalized. They take real trials and then they fictionalize them, and it was on every day. So it was a great treat. And my sister hated all this, and so she was always crying. And he would say to her, "Stop grizzling," which was a sort of colloquialism for crying. Whereas I would absolutely love, you know, I'd go there, he'd buy me a donut, a comic, a book, and we'd sit and watch the crime shows. And you know, and I just really, you know, yeah, I found him a great company. But he was quite puritanical. I think that's quite partly where my dad didn't really get on with him. And my dad was always sort of doing rebellious things. I mean, they're not that rebellious, but they like buying a motorbike and hiding it in a cupboard and taking it apart, or buying a guitar. You know, he really wanted to be a musician, or boxing, and he would be doing these adventures. And my grandfather, who was quite down after the death of his wife, was very particular. You know, he just didn't really want any sort of liveliness around him, and hated people being very lively. And I was quite happy to not be lively and to sit there and just draw and write and read and watch TV. And it was, you know, it was sort of idyllic for me. And I got on, I think of all of my relations, he's the one that I sort of got on with the best. So yeah, that was my grandfather. And then my father, yeah, we get on pretty well. I mean, he had a very difficult childhood, as I say, because his mother had died when he was 12, and I think that hit him very hard.
Was he an only child, or?
Yeah, no, he was an only child, and he got around it by having lots of pets. He had all these pets, and all of their names, because his name was David, so he gave all of his pets names starting with D. So he had Donald the tortoise, and Derek the hedgehog, and Douglas the dog, and all, you know. So he was, and he was constantly coming up with ways of entertaining himself. Mm-hmm. And he started out working in as a teacher. He went to teach training college, and then pretty early on, around the time of my birth, my mother was concerned that the teacher's salary wouldn't be enough. She wasn't working at the time, wouldn't be enough to support the whole family. So he went to work for Rolls-Royce. Mm. And while he was there, they were told that they were going to be starting to use more electronics and computing. And at the time, computers, you know, it was long before home computers. And so he was given a test to see if he would be any good at this. And he'd always liked maths. And he was a natural, you know, he really liked computing. So they started him off as a computer programmer. And he then moved from Rolls-Royce into insurance and worked for various insurance companies as a systems analyst. So he was really into computer. And in fact, it's weird, in our family, he's much more technically minded than anyone else. He's retired recently, but before that he was teaching at what used to be called a technical college, but he was teaching computing and quite advanced computing and programming. So he's always been interested in technology. And when we were younger, he would have a friend at work who was even more into the sort of personal computing stuff. And so he would get like the Apple II or the early Atari and would buy all the games, and then he'd get bored of it and then give it to my dad. So my dad would come home with these computers and hundreds of games, and we would sit and play all these games. And I think my sister got quite into it, and she does websites and things like that. But I wasn't really that into it. It was odd. I sort of liked the games a bit, and I did a little bit of early programming. I sort of sat there making sort of fantasy games where you would, you know, press N to go north or whatever. But I didn't map it out. So when you pressed N to go north or S to go south, you went somewhere completely different every time. So the games didn't really make any sense. But I think that was the beginning of me thinking of starting to write, was a combination of drawing comics and doing computer programming. And that started me thinking about alternative worlds. And I mean, I don't really write. I mean, my children's fiction has some fantasy elements, but my main fiction is sort of literary fiction. So it doesn't really have that, but it does have the sense of creating characters and creating worlds. And I just did that obsessively for ages, was sort of drawing comics and teaching myself to learn narrative and writing these computer games. But then I started to just read a lot of books, and I went to eventually got into Cambridge University over here. And that was a real revelation to me, because, you know, I'd gone to a school which really wasn't very interested in educating people, and, you know, it wasn't a particularly good school. But off the back of that, I became a very independent learner, and I spent a lot of time just reading everything. You know, I just was just really interested in contemporary fiction. And then when I went to university, they were like, you know, I mean, the university, Cambridge University Library, is one of the three main copyright libraries in the UK. So it has absolutely everything that's published. Mm. right back to the beginning of time, you know, and so you, or, you know, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly, and you can get it all out and you can look at anything, you know, I mean, you can really, you know, so I spent most of my time at university just reading, you know, trying to catch up because I hadn't had a, you know, particularly good education. But I was fascinated and I loved reading lots of stuff. And, you know, and then off the back of that, after I finished at Cambridge, I went and did a creative writing MLit in St. Andrews in Scotland. And I was so naive, I didn't actually realize, because my director of studies at Cambridge told me that St. Andrews had a beach, and I was picturing Baywatch, you know, and the reality, geography has never been a strong point of mine. And, you know, the reality is it's the coldest beach you've ever been on in your life. And it is, you know, 0 degrees all the year round, and the sea's frozen and it snows and it's horrible. And I spent a year there and it was just so cold that all I did was stay inside and write this novel. And it was useful in a way, because then I, you know, I got published pretty early on. I sold my first short story at 22 and my first novel came out at 23. And it pretty much gave me a career. I mean, I managed to make a living purely from my writing from 98 to about 2005. And then I started to do a bit of university teaching after that to sort of make ends meet. I mean, I could have carried on just about making a living from the writing, but as it started to take me longer to do things like the Prince book took me 7 years. So when you work out what I got, I mean, I got a good advance for that book, but when it's spread over 7 years, it's not a, you know, it's not quite enough of a salary.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I had to do a bit of teaching alongside the writing, but you know, even that, all of that came from the books as well. So it was really, you know, that early being locked in a room writing really sort of helped me, set me up for life, really.
And did you not write any of the children's books until you had your kids?
No, very much the opposite. I wrote them before I had children, and it was a complete mistake because I just didn't understand what boys were like. And it was that the books are aimed at 9 to 12 year old girls.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of thought it'd be 9 to 12 year old girls and boys, you know, that sort of have a literary interest, or, you know, a sort of more gentle boys, I guess, in some ways. And I didn't realize that no boys are like that, you know, and you can be the most intelligent 9-year-old in the world and you still want to read about people hitting each other with swords and fighting and clobbering each other. And I'd written 3 novels that were set in the future, but were essentially realistic and were quite densely, you know, sort of, I mean, they were based on Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, the Renaissance sort of manners guide. So they're about children learning how to behave. And all the children in the book, they all live in different castles and they travel to these castles. And nobody knows what else is out there in the world, because it's after a, you know, a disaster in the future. And they've returned to more of a kind of rural way of life. And there's a lot of suspense in the books and there's a lot of scary moments, but there isn't much swordplay or fighting or, you know, or monsters or any of the things that boys like. So my children have read them, but they're not particularly excited about them, and they don't really talk about them very much. So it was a moment that kind of, I'm proud of the books, but I don't know what I was thinking, to be honest. I just I'd finished a novel that was really hard to write, and then I just had this. I was listening to a Neil Young album, Hawks and Doves, which at that point hadn't been released on CD. So I was listening to a kind of unofficial version of that, and there's a song on there that it's about Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and it has this a metaphorical description. Then it has this rider arriving at a castle. And I just saw this vision in my mind of this kind of remembering the college system at university, where they almost are like little castles, and then combining that with Renaissance, remembering reading Renaissance literature, and combined with a kind of slightly sort of fantasy element, and trying to think, how can I get all of those ingredients into one? And I wrote all 3 books in one mad binge. It took me about 3 months.
Wow.
And I mean, I didn't sleep, and I was sending them to friends at the time going, you know, is this any good? Is this crazy? And I went to see a children's book agent, and she said, you know, this is exactly what, because they're quite prescriptive with the rules for children's books. They said, this hits it exactly. You know, it's exactly the right length. The chapter's the right length. It's, you know, it's got everything that children's publishers are looking for. So I sold it quite quickly. It was all happened quite easily. And it was, you know, it was a reasonable amount of money, and it all, you know, it all went quite well. And the first book sold really, really well. But then we decided to do the second, and the publisher decided to do the second and third one in quite quick succession. And I don't think there was enough time for the audience to, I think if we kept going and we'd done 6 of them, maybe an audience would have picked up. But it was one of those things where the deal was for 3 books. I'd written the 3 books. I was waiting around for 18 months to see how they would do, to see if I'd write another 3. and they didn't do quite well enough for me to carry on doing them. So they kind of, and the only thing I'm depressed about or disappointed about in the experience was that I was so convinced I'd get at least another three to finish off the story that the last line of the third one is, "This is not the end," which I should have maybe known at the time was a hostage to fortune. But I, you know, it's sort of, I had a good plan for what was going to happen in 4, 5, and 6. So I was disappointed that I didn't get to do that. But, you know,
I just had I had an amazing vision of you going around at least England and finding all of those copies of the third book and opening them up and crossing out the word "not" in each of the books and just angrily traveling around the country to find all of them. This is the end.
Yeah. That's a good idea. I should do that. Yeah, no, I could see myself. But that's one of the things that nobody tells you about writing kids' books is that unless you're J.K. Rowling, you know, or somebody of almost that size, a lot of children's writing is a bit sort of like being a surrogate teacher, you know, because you know, they don't, there's a bit of promotion, but not that much promotion because, you know, as with a lot of books, it's word of mouth, but particularly with kids' books, it's going to schools, it's giving a talk and then selling your books afterwards. And, you know, and you're watching all the kids come up and there's one kid who hasn't got enough money and, you know, you just feel guilty all the time. Or I did with it, you know, I just didn't feel it was what I wanted to do. So I didn't follow that up. I didn't write any more children's books. You know, I just felt like, okay, that was it. That was it for me for that field. I went back to write another adult book and then I wrote the Prince books. And I don't think I would do it again because I don't, as I say, I know what kids like now, but I don't really like those books. I don't really like reading them. Sort of, you know, I mean, I don't mind reading them aloud to I like reading to my children. I like, you know, but I, you know, it's sort of, I don't really get what I was trying to get in this book was the sort of thing I remembered from children's books when I was a child. And I think they've now changed so much.
Yeah. And dramatically.
And modern kids are so, you know, they're so different that it doesn't make sense for me to do that anymore.
Yeah. The change of imagination alone in youth is, I mean, what technology and immediate gratification has done to that for kids is an immense subject. I mean, that's something that definitely you could really, really delve into because it's so much different from, I mean, you and I aren't that much different in age, but you know, what we would take from reading a book and now from, I mean, there's the heavy hitters, obviously. If you're reading a Harry Potter book, you've probably seen the movie. And or you're like pausing your reading to watch some of it in the movie or whatever, and your imagination has been so tainted and overridden by what you're able to obtain. I mean, I just saw, what was the movie? Oh, we just saw Boss Baby yesterday.
I saw that.
Saw the preview for Captain Underpants.
Yeah.
Did you guys get that trailer in as well?
My kids love that book.
Which my son will. He's 4, so maybe he will get into it later. But I know that's a humongous book series that now is getting its treatment, and it seems like there's a lot of those. I mean, Goosebumps finally did their movie, and
No, I mean, I see them all, you know, because I mean, I love the cinema, but it's weird. I have to force my children to see these films. I made them go and see the Smurfs with me. They didn't want to see the Smurfs. I mean, probably rightly so. I made but Boss Baby. They were my youngest son wanted to see Boss Baby, so that was we were in agreement on that. But I was in Berlin last week, and I made them go and see the Power Rangers film with me, very much against their will. And it's not, you know, but the film doesn't mean, like, when I was a kid, I loved going to the cinema. In fact, I loved it so much, I got a job when I was about 12 reviewing films for the local radio station. Again, it was something, really? It was a formative thing that, and I managed to sneak in to review the manager liked me, and the radio station didn't know how old I was. So I got to review all the films, you know, the R-rated, what the equivalent of R-rated, all of them, you know. So I was seeing 4 or 5 films a week in my teenage years. But my kids just don't really want to go to the cinema. I mean, occasionally a film will pop up on their radar that they're interested in, but they would much rather stay at home and play video games or, you know, or do various other things or play on their phones than they would go to the cinema and watch a movie. And it, you know, I mean, because I remember having this big argument with my dad one time where I'd gone to see Roman Polanski's Pirates, And it was so, I thought it was so terrible, but I didn't want to, I didn't want to say that to my dad that it was terrible, because we went to see a film once a month and it was a big deal for him as well. And I could tell he wanted to be nice to me and taking me to the film. And then later on, he saw me filling out a survey for Time Out magazine about, no, Venue magazine, which is the Bristol equivalent of Time Out. And it was, what was the worst film you saw all year? And I wrote down Pirates. And my dad was like, I thought you loved that film. You were really excited. And I said, look, well, the thing was that I was so worried about hurting your feelings because I thought maybe you wouldn't take me again, you know, if I didn't like that film. And this, after this, he took me to the cinema every week instead of every month, because, you know, I was saying that, you know, if I didn't like a film, I then had a month to wait before the next one, and I didn't get to see a lot of the films that I wanted to see. So, you know, so then, from then on, you know, from my childhood onwards, you know, I was seeing at least a film a week, sometimes four or five. And now, you know, I mean, I don't get to go to the, I go to music, to concerts two or three times a week, but I don't get to go to the cinema anywhere near as, you know, much as I used to. And it's one of the things that's sort of fallen by the wayside a little bit. So I desperately look at the kids' films thinking, which ones am I going to, you know, which one's going to have enough kind of nourishment? Mm-hmm. I went to see The Maze Runner 2, The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, without seeing the first one. And my son had seen the first one and read all the books. And I was like, there's no mazes. They're not running. I don't understand what the Scorch Trials are. And he was going, oh, Dad, you know, if you'd seen the first one, you'd understand this. And part of me was enjoying watching this thing that was baffling. But equally, at the same time, I was thinking, some of this stuff is really just dreadful. You know, it's really, it's beyond, you know, it's not just sort of, you know, there's the first level of you know, like, I mean, I'm not a massive Hunger Games fan, but I know people who are obsessive about the Hunger Games, and I can, like, adults, and I can see why people do it. But then some of the second level sort of knockoffs of that just seems to be such a strange world where, you know, it's a bit like when I'm teaching students how to do creative writing, and they're watching this kind of stuff and then coming back and they go, well, it's like this book. And I'm thinking, well, yes, it is, but I don't, it's not good.
Yeah. How old are your boys, by the way?
They are 8 and 11.
Okay. My oldest is 8 and my youngest is 4. So I've got a little bit for them to grow till I'm at kind of your boys' comprehension level. So it's a much different grouping that I'm dealing with than 11 and 8.
Yeah, yeah. I guess for sure. Yeah. No, it's weird. I mean, it's sort of, there's just enough of a distance for them. I mean, we were hoping that all the competitiveness wouldn't be there, but some of it's there. But there's just enough of a distance between them for them to sort of, for the older one to sort of look after the younger one up to a point, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what is the age gap between you and your sister and between your wife and her brother?
Me and my sister, it's 18 months. I always get this, sorry, 21 months between my sister and I always get the three ran the wrong way. No, 21.
Almost 2 years, yeah.
Almost 2 years, yeah.
And your dad, you're saying, just turned 70. So he was about almost in his 30s when he had you.
Yeah, I think he was exactly 30.
Doing that as quick math.
He was exactly 30. Yeah, I'm impressed. He was exactly 30 when he had my sister.
Okay.
I think, is that okay? Right? Yes. So yeah. So, and then, cause that's, we can always remember it by that their birthdays, they have the big birthdays in the same year.
And so you are fairly close to following suit exactly with your kids doing even more fast math.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. It was around about the same time.
So how similar do you kind of see your relationship or how you relate to, even just at the beginning, maybe with your firstborn, as to how things were between you and your dad?
Without wanting to offend him, I don't know if he'll listen to this or not, he may do, okay. But and I don't mean this in a horrible way, but I almost tried to do the exact opposite that my dad did with me. But not because he was a terrible father or is a terrible father, you know. And also I should add that my parents divorced when I was 12, I think, but they were sort of on the rocks from 8 onwards. Mm. And my dad raised me, you know, my mum went off I didn't see much of my mother, and so he raised me and my sister.
Okay, quick questions before you get too deep in that. Did your dad remarry?
No. He had various girlfriends, and he's got a girlfriend now, but he didn't want to remarry. He was always sort of against the idea of it.
Okay, so another kind of parallel then of the working your way up to your grandfather then.
Yeah. No, it's around the same sort of time.
Age and everything. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And we would talk about that sometimes, about, you know, the fact that he literally didn't have a mother from that period, and I didn't see much of my mother, you know, and the sort of differences between that. But to go back to sort of justify what I mean about being different, my dad was, I think he would say that his dad was hard and he wasn't hard. But I felt that I didn't get much approval. But I don't think that was necessarily a case of him wanting to be critical or wanting to be, you know, being I think he would feel that he was quite loving. And I don't think he was unloving. It's just that I don't think I really understood that he felt that way about me. You know, I think I, you know, I just sort of, I mean, I think it, my father and I were so sort of different in our interests that it wasn't, I mean, well, also, you know, it was also sort of like the generational change. Like my dad was, you know, like every weekend, my dad would do DIY. You know, I mean, that was a big thing at the time, you know, so he would be doing, you know, odd jobs around the house. You know, he would be making, I don't know, you know, doing bits and pieces, you know, and the thing, and even when we were going to the cinema, the thing was that like, I had to wait till he'd finished whatever jobs he was doing to go to the cinema, you know, and I'd sit there waiting, thinking, oh, you know, I hope he finishes the job. I mean, if he didn't finish the job, we wouldn't get to go, you know, and that was quite depressing. So part of me was thinking, okay, well, I'm not going to do that with my kids. You know, weekends, I'm going to say, you know, I'm there for you. What do you want to do? You know, we'll do whatever you want. You know, I'll take you to the cinema or the rest of it. And of course, then they don't want to go to the cinema. So, you know, it's that sort of thing that they'll probably grow up thinking, oh, Dad was always trying to make us go and see these terrible films at the cinema because, you know, that was what I wanted, you know, and felt I didn't have until he, you know, I mean, and I really wanted my dad to play games with me. You know, I really wanted him to play snooker and pool and all the rest of it. So I play a lot of board games and things with my kids and the rest of it. But then, you know, but then a lot of the time they'll want to hang out with their friends, or you know, they'll the technology is different, so they want to play the computer games with the headsets on, talking to other people. You know, so it's that sort of thing of, you know, I'm sure I will be just, I will have the just as much resentment, I'm sure, aimed at me, even though I it's kind of like well, no, I don't mean that in a terrible way. I mean, I don't, you know, I know. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I conscientiously try to be as good a dad as I could possibly be. But I think my dad probably did too. It's just that it was a different way of doing it.
It was a different circumstance too, yeah.
And a different era, you know. So it was sort of, you know, it's kind of, I would just gabble on all the time at my dad about stuff, you know. And I could tell a lot of the time he wasn't listening or drifting off. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm not going to be like that with my children. I'm really going to try and listen to what they're saying. And then, but you know, it's like you're walking along and your child's much smaller than you, and you know, and you can't hear exactly what they're saying, and you keep stopping and listening to it, and you're thinking, maybe he's sitting there thinking, you know, I'm saying this stuff that's really important and Dad's not hearing it. And, you know, it's sort of, it's not a conscious, deliberate thing. And I think also that, you know, it was tricky with having a sibling that was a sister, because, you know, there were lots of things about keeping her happy and doing things that she wanted to do. And it was, you know, sort of, it was much more of a difference. You know, the two boys most of the time want to do the same thing. You know, it's fairly easy to negotiate them into doing the same thing, whereas me and my sister would want to do completely opposite things, you know. So it was more, and my mum would want to do something different again when she was there, you know, and my dad would have lots of other things that that would be on his mind. So it was, you know, it was, I don't know, it's I suppose when I say I'm trying to do the opposite, it's like, not that I feel like he was a bad father, but I feel that I remember keenly resentment, you know. I mean, things that annoyed me as a child. And I think, you know, I don't want my children to experience that. But then I realize that I've upset them in some other way, you know, because, you know, do you know what I mean? It's sort of like I think that's part of being a dad, isn't it? That, you know, that you have these arguments or differences or whatever, and you work through them, you know, that it's very, I mean, and that's something that I have kind of learned through being a dad that I didn't as a son or a brother, because, you know, I would just retreat to my room and write, you know, I wouldn't bother. And I think it was quite weird I mean, my mum writes occasional stuff. She writes business books and things like that. But I think for my dad, I think he just thought it was a bit strange. And I remember one time we went on holiday and there was a competition to write a horror story or something in a magazine. And I said to my dad, you know, well, why don't you and I both do it? And then we'll both enter and see if either has any luck, you know. And he was sort of interested for a moment, and he sat down and tried to start writing a horror story. And, you know, and he wrote half a page and gave up because it wasn't his thing, you know, it wasn't his thing. And then I sit down and write a whole story, and I'd look at him and go, well, why haven't you, where's your story? You know, and it's sort of, it's weird, you know, and And I don't, you know, I don't do that with my kids, and I don't expect them to have the same interests, and I don't, you know. Yeah. But it, you know, I mean, and it's really, I mean, as you know, doing anything sort of creative or any, you know, anything where you're sort of trying to create something and put it in the world is pretty tough, you know, and it takes time and it takes dedication, and it's, but when you're a son, you're thinking, well, I don't care if anyone needs me particularly right now, you know, I want to go in and write this story, but then as a dad, I mean, I know some writers of the sort of previous generation who just shut the door and ignored their, I mean, men and women, you know, who, you know, closed the door and just wrote their books, and that was what they were doing, and I've very much always had an open door policy with my children, you know, that they can get me whenever I want, and also, you know, that I'm not writing all the time, you know, I've sort of stopped. Right, I mean, before I had children, I'd be writing 7 days a week, you know, all the way around the clock. And now I'm not, you know, I sort of, you know, I stopped to have family time, mm-hmm. when they get home from school or whatever, you know. And you know, and I think that's one of those things that's quite different, you know, quite with my generation. All the novelists that I know, and I know quite a lot of novelists, all sort of slowed down when they had, particularly the men, more than the men, most of the women actually sort of managed to keep going at the same, at roughly the same speed, but the men, I think, slowed down quite a lot. I think that, you know, it's just sort of, you can, when I was working on a book, and when my son was very small, and, you know, I was writing quite a dark scene, or, you know, a depressing bit, and then he would crawl in or whatever, you know, and then you stop and play with your son, and you can't go back to the dark space that you were
right,
yeah. You know, you have to start writing something different, or not writing at all, or writing. I mean, and that's why I pretty much, well, not, I mean, I had the deal for The Prince book before my son was born, but I mean, that's why I focused more on that then, because it was easier to write nonfiction, and it sort of was easier to sit in my office listening to music and thinking about that than it was to sort of wrench, you know, psychological depth out of your, mm-hmm. out of your soul, you know, and then be a dad, you know.
So. Yeah, and why the writing that you're doing as a critic and whatnot right now is probably much easier to kind of jump in and jump out as well.
Yeah, and also, and the film, you know, I was working on this film of 8 Minutes Idle, my second novel, but it came out much later on as a film. And the thing about that was that there were lots of drafts. I mean, I started out co-writing it, but towards the end I was doing quite a lot of it, the lion's sort of share of it. And it was much more a case of, right, okay, so it's 3 days of intense work, and then you hand it in, and then you have to wait 2 weeks till all the producers and everybody reads it and the actors read it and all the rest of it, you know, so it fits in with the schedule a lot easier. I mean, the thing about a novel is that it just sucks up all of your time and attention, mm-hmm. whereas film work or TV work or criticism or, you know, or nonfiction, it's easy to get in and out of, you know, you can have this process of, you know, leaving your desk and not thinking about it for the rest of the day, whereas your brain, when you're writing a novel, you're always trying to solve problems all the time. And you finish the day and you're absolutely physically whacked in a way that you're not with. I mean, it might be hard to come up with funny dialogue or to deal with notes or the rest of it, but it's just not the same. You know, it's not the same kind of all-consuming thing that a novel is. I had a friend, I had a female friend who said a child is worth two novels. You know, that was the way she had three children and she had three novels, and it was like, you know, so, and I think that's that each child, I think, takes away two novels, but they're novels that you're happy to give up, I think, so, unless you're a psychopath. Yes.
Yeah. So do you think that you will ever kind of delve back into that side of work, especially when your kids are older, or do you think that you've kind of had your romance with that?
No, I mean, the next thing that I've got coming out, which is this Project High, is a novel, but it's an app, rather. It's this thing called Oulipo. It's this new app. And it's a novel plus, basically. You know, you get the novel and you also get film and music, and you can choose there's a degree. It's not entirely choosing different narratives, but there are bits of it where you can follow one particular narrative strand or not follow another particular narrative strand. Much more of a kind of multimedia project. And I kind of wanted to do that. I mean, they came to me and they're, you know, it's an interesting company, an interesting startup. And I thought it would be interesting to try and do that. And it looks, I've just seen the first chapter of 10, which they've done. And you can see that that's on the iTunes. If you download the Oulipo app, you can see the first chapter there. The rest is yet to come. I think it's coming mid-April. But that's a novel, you know. I mean, it's a different novel in the sense that it's not a print novel, and it probably won't be, because I wrote it to have images with it, you know, so there's less description than you would have in a novel, because a bit of film comes up and you see the characters, or you read their emails, or you know, or their messages or whatever, you know. So and it utilizes the technology of your phone. But I was doing that as a kind of a soft return to novel writing, really. So there'll be another novel, but I'm not entirely sure. I haven't decided next whether it will be. I've got an idea for another music book about lots of artists, not focusing on one artist like I did with The Prince, but I'm working on a couple of TV programs at the moment. And yeah, you know, I mean, I'm always working on lots of different things. So I mean, it's which one sort of forces its way to the forefront. But I'm definitely not done with the novel. I've had quite a sort of mixed period over the last sort of 10 years, where I've gone from, you know, I wrote 6 novels in 6 years. I wrote 3 children's books in very quick succession. And then I wrote The Prince book over a long time, and the film took a long time, you know, and the two, and those sort of coincided as well. So that, I mean, like, you know, as you know, with films, it's sort of, you know, there's like 2 or 3 months where they're actually shooting, but the development takes a long, you know, is 2 or 3 years leading up to that. So there are all these overlapping projects, and I really enjoyed working on the film. And I, you know, so part of me just liked getting out, not being locked in the office anymore, you know, and going out and I mean, and also that was easy with kids as well, because, you know, you're actually sitting on a set and people need you, you know, so you're not, you know, there's a justification that you can't necessarily make if you're just sitting at home all day writing.
Right.
So I don't really know. I haven't really decided quite what the next project is at this exact moment, but I know there are 4 or 5 possibilities. I mean, one of the TV things I'm working on, if that gets the green light, I'll be working on that, and that will take all my time. If that comes to an end, I'll probably look at this music book, and I think I'll probably be writing the music book and the novel, next novel, simultaneously, but we'll see. I mean, it's hard, you know, I used to feel very clear. It was like, I mean, in fact, when I was a kid, I made a list of my New Year's resolutions, and they were write a first novel by this point, a second novel by that point, a third novel, you know, and you know, and I did it, you know, that was all what I did. But then after a certain point, you know, you just think, well, okay, well, I could just keep writing novels. But I sort of feel like I want to try different things now as well. You know, I really, the thing I loved about working on a film was hearing actors do your dialogue, and just because the novel that was turned into a film, I wrote it when I was 23, 24. And then by the time the film came out, I was in my late 30s.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Early 40s, you know. But the characters in it are all 20 somethings. So the actors were, apart from a couple, but the actors were mainly 20 somethings. And they were a totally different generation, you know, and so their world was completely different. So the whole project was completely reinvented. But one of the things that was interesting was the actors saying to me, well, I wouldn't say that, and I'd say it like this, and I went, you know, and being alive to those changes and being able, having that kind of sense of your characters talking to you is a very intoxicating thing, you know. So then go back to the just creating the whole of a character is harder again.
Yeah, I can imagine how big that process is, especially being so many years removed from it and going back into it so long after.
Yeah.
So now with your dad in his, I heard you kind of catch yourself, and I can imagine being 70 and having somebody saying, I'm in my 70s, and saying to them, I'm only 70.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I know exactly what you mean. And it's sort of, I don't know. It's kind of like I want to think of him as being in his 70s for some reason. I just sort of want to, I don't know. It's sort of weird, isn't it? I mean, aging's an odd thing, I think.
Yes.
And people do it at different speeds, and it happens at different times and all the rest of it, you know. And he, I think he would be somebody who would say that, you know, I'm only 70.
So what is his, how far away is he from you? Is he still up in Bristol or?
No, he lives in the countryside. He lives in a place called Melksham, which is not near me at all. No, he lives with his girlfriend, and we go down and visit him occasionally. We went to visit him a few months ago, not as often as I'd like. And I think I'd be quite nice for him to come up more as well, but it's, I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, it's sort of this may make sense. There may be an American equivalent. I'm not sure quite what it is. And maybe the way that people outside of New York think of New York, but there's a certain difference between London and the rest of England, and some people, not everybody, but some people who live in the countryside hate London, or you know, or see it as, or see it as quite a sort of psychic trauma. I mean, similarly to the way, you know, if you lived in the countryside, going to New York for some people would probably seem like it's too fast, it's too frenetic, it's too crowded, claustrophobic, whatever, you know. And I think he feels like, yeah, like that, you know. So it's a big deal for him to come to London, and even more so for my mum. I mean, my mum hasn't been to London for years and years, so that's a factor. And it's sort of, and it's the same, I think, with my wife's parents as well. And it's, although they're slightly better about it. So it's, yeah, it's sort of weird. It's kind of, and it's one of those things that if you don't live in London and you come to London, you can just see the downside of it. You can see the kind of the bustle of it, you know, in a way that,
yeah,
you don't see it if you live there. I mean, I remember when I first came up from Bristol and just going on the subway, just the speed of people was terrifying. And also almost like, you know, sort of almost like a hallucinogenic, you know, just the sort of the, just seeing people moving at such a speed in a different way of life. And then of course, once you've been here a few months, you're elbowing the people aside who are taking, well, I'm not, right, but you know what I mean? You know, the people who are, one of these people do it, you know, cause everybody's operating at that speed.
Yeah.
And it suits me temperamentally, but he's very much of a different temperament. He's much sort of slower and more methodical and not somebody who likes that fast paced movement.
Well, I remember when I was living out there in Lancaster, and which is, for those of you who aren't in the know, it's in the Northwest, and is, I mean, I was at the university, so it was, you know, I wasn't just completely out in the sticks, but Lancaster is not a huge town, and it's not, you know, it's not a complete farm life either, but it's up in the north, and it's very far away from London, and much unlike London. And the couple times I did go down there, even being from Southern California, where I'm not, you know, out in the sticks here either, it was quite a, you know, you took a deep breath when you got into the subway system or into the people system.
Yeah. I mean, even New York, you know, you think of as a kind of really busy metropolis, but you know, the sidewalks are huge in comparison to the small pavements, you know, the tiny little pavements that you've got in London with people rushing around, you know. So it really is quite, I can see how it can have a sort of psychic cost on. I mean, I've heard it described as sort of like a, you know, a fairground ride that, you know, when you're on it, you're really enjoying it. But the minute you get off, you just sort of, and I feel that a bit as well, when, you know, when you go to the countryside, you're just like, whoa, you know, it's so.
Yeah. And I've never been to New York, but I've seen, you know, I'm not ignorant, I've seen it and seen what the countryside around there, countryside in quotes, around there is like. And I don't think it still would compare to the, you know, it's kind of like going from a cold pool to a hot jacuzzi.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting in and like having that shock, or the reverse. I guess it would be more so like the reverse.
You have the comfort
of the warm water and then jumping into the cold when you get into the big city and just like being overwhelmed by it.
When I took my kids, we go to LA occasionally, and I last time I was out there with my children, we were wandering around together, and we were waiting to cross the road, and this man came up to us and he said, oh, look at you two, you know, being very organized about waiting for the light. And they had this whole conversation, and they were just really perplexed that somebody would have the time to stop and talk about the process of crossing the road. And particularly to that, you know, somebody would see some kids happily talk, have this conversation with them, you know, whereas in England, you'd have the cars tooting and you'd have everybody, you know, like elbowing you. And then, you know, and if somebody, you'd think they were completely mad if they said, look at you crossing the road, you know, they would just be so they like that. And they like that, you know, they like the kind of, you know, the kind of conversational nature of California, and, you know, and the kind of way that people are interested in each other. And they, you know, not everybody, but, you know, generally, you know, there's much more of a kind of a feel of people being interested in what everyone else is up to, which is very much not the case in London. It may be in other parts of England, you know, and everybody, that's what everybody, you know, says about the North is much friendlier and much warmer. And, you know, and you do have that kind of sense of people being more of a community than they are elsewhere. But I mean, places are changing. I mean, I went last week, I was in Berlin, and, you know, it's such a millennial, or I mean, I was in East Berlin, but, you know, such a millennial run city, you know. And it's, you know, we go for breakfast and everybody there in the restaurant is on their phone, you know, and nobody's talking to each other at all. And You know, and it, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not judging about that. You know, I'm as guilty of that as anyone else. But it was, you know, it was, it, you just see how places, you know, the kind of technology is changing people and generations are changing people. And, you know, and so it's very hard to make, you know, the north of England's probably different now than it was, you know, the last time I went.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So things are changing all the time. And yeah, and you've got, and, you know, and kind of like my memory of growing up in Bristol. I mean, people say about Bristol is that everything happens there much slowly than it does in the rest of the world. And it is a city that runs on its own pace. And, you know, people don't, there's not that many successful people from Bristol because they can't be bothered to get around to it because they're having such a nice time, you know. And there are, there are lots of really great things about Bristol. Like you can wander around going from nightclub to nightclub and then you're not being charged an extortionate amount of money because, you know, people just do that. And you go out in the city. I mean, when I would go out in Bristol as a kid, I would see virtually everyone I knew from the city on a night out. And you would never make a plan to meet your friends because you would just meet them in the city. You'd run into them in the city centre, you know. So when I first moved to London and people would say, okay, let's meet, but I can't do it for 3 weeks until 3 weeks time and I can only do it at this particular period, you know. And now, of course, I'm like that, like everybody else. But at the time, it was like, this is such a strange way of living, you know. Why don't people, surely we'll see each other all in a bar tonight or, mm-hmm. you know, or the cinema or the, you know, art gallery or whatever. But it's, I mean, you do bump into people in London, but it's much bigger city and it's, you know, such more of a kind of diverse place that, and meeting people is, I mean, it's not as bad as LA in terms of having to drive to meet people all the time. You know, the transport system is easier.
Yeah.
But there is, sure. But you do have to focus on it. You know, you still have to sort of concentrate on getting it, sorting it out.
And do you use technology in your favor with connecting with your dad and his grandsons? I mean, are you guys able to kind of make it a little bit different than it would have been back 30 years ago with the distance between you guys?
Not really, but maybe we should do more of that. I mean, my dad and sister do a lot of that, and they were keen mm-hmm. for me to sort of get involved in that. But I've been a bit resistant to it, really. I mean, I talk to them a lot on the phone. I tend to phone my dad every week and my mum every week. And we text each other every now and again, but he sort of, you know, often doesn't have his phone or doesn't respond or, you know, so, mm-hmm. and he's got a different phone, so he can't get the pictures and all the rest of it. So, I don't know, it sort of
feels distant and disconnected to you.
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. I mean, and he's really, you know, he's quite into sort of Skype, but sort of with the camera and things like that. And I always find it a bit odd. You know, I don't really, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm talking to you now on a different system and it, you know, it feels very relaxed and I'm enjoying talking to you and it's a nice experience. But I, you know, when you're looking at a picture and they're wandering off and there are other people in there and, you know, it just doesn't really, also just to be sitting there staring at my dad's phone.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
It's a sort of weird experience. But no, he does love technology, and I think he, you know, it's something maybe he would like to do more of. But then again, but also I don't know, you know, it's quite the sort of fiddliness of it and all the rest of it.
It's weird too. I mean, you know, the way your kids are, and it sounds like they're very into technology in their own way and into their video games and whatnot. And it is still different to, I mean, all the connections that we make through technology, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or Skype or, you know, what have you, through our phones, you know, like people say, it's kind of cliche, I guess, but it connects us all, but it also keeps us at a distance.
Mm.
So it is kind of both sides of that weird feel to it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm quite bad at sort of keeping up with the most current technology. I mean, you know, most people, it seems, don't really like email, you know, and would much rather do things on Twitter or, mm-hmm. you know, that big transition that took place where people stopped sort of having, I mean, I remember like being a writer, being at home, my equivalent of kind of office banter or office conversation was sort of email chains that would go on all day, you know, and I knew that, and I would have, and it would be friends with other writers and people working in offices and we'd email each other back and forth. And then suddenly there seemed to be, And I had a few message boards with other writers and stuff, but then suddenly everybody was on Twitter and I was a bit suspicious of Twitter and I didn't really join Twitter until the film, you know, in fact, because what happened was with 8 Minutes Idle, they told us we had to get a Facebook account, which mm-hmm. was set up, but was never really used, and a Twitter account, which I eventually, and that's why it's 8 Minutes Idle rather than Matt Thorne. When we started doing it, I put my address book into it, you know, so suddenly all of my friends were on there. And I was giving them updates of the film, which they eventually got a bit tired and bored of. So I transitioned eventually into a personal account. But I think if I hadn't done that, I probably wouldn't have had I don't have a Facebook page or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there's something in me that quite likes the separation of the kind of public and private. You know, it's sort of, I'm quite happy to, like, I'd think of a joke and I might text it to a friend or email like four or five friends. But I wouldn't necessarily want to put the same joke up on Twitter.
Right, right.
And it's partly...
It's very different, too. The public consumption of that.
Yeah, and it's partly because I wear so many different hats. You know, it's like, I am a lecturer at a university, so, you know, there's a kind of public part of that. You know, I am a novelist, so, you know, there's that. And I'm written about prints, and there's lots of people who follow lots of prints. Like, you know, and in fact, one of the kind of... most gratifying things about Twitter is the sort of Prince fans that I've met through that. And, but then also there was this film, you know, and I was publicizing the film and so it felt like I had to be quite careful about what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And also I feel like I've got a lot of different interests. Like, you know, I mean, I might be talking about avant-garde film or, a lot of the music I like that's not Prince is more on the kind of free jazz or the improv or noise rock, sort of end of things. So talking on Twitter about experimental music one, and then talking about the Boss Baby or whatever, you know, it's a sort of, it's kind of like, I know, but the thing is, I guess I'm just thinking about it too much because everybody does it, don't they? Everybody puts it. But I do have some friends, particularly novelist friends, who are that sort of create a brand on Twitter. You know, they kind of they have things that they talk about or things that they don't talk about.
Yeah,
to fit their brand, you know, they're like, and I'm much more of a kind of, I mean, I guess the thing is that I'm not saying this is a kind of boast or anything, but just the kind of person I am, you know, I have very broad, wide ranging tastes. You know, I like a lot of different music, I like a lot of different films, a lot of different books, and a lot of different genres. You know, and I'm very interested in kind of, you know, what people might consider highbrow stuff, and also quite lowbrow stuff as well. And I mean, again, I know a lot of people are, but you know. It can be quite hard to push all of that through the conduit of Twitter or whatever, you know, whereas...
And on the one account.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's that's also the same thing that, like, you know, you've got your friend who's into American football over here is very different to how it is for you. It's much more of a kind of a, for want of a better word, a kind of a kind of hipster kind of appropriation, you know. So I've got but I don't like it for that reason. I like it because I like to take my kids to watch American football because there's not much sport they're all interested in, but we love going to watch, you know, they started doing the international series and do American football games over here. And it's not, maybe it's slightly different than it would be in America because it's such entertaining spectacle for buttoned up British people to be exposed to that. It's very enjoyable, you know. So I'd email my friend about American football, then another friend, if I was tweeting about it, it'd be like, why on earth are you suddenly going on about America? You know, it could be the last thing in the world.
Who are you?
Yeah, you know, exactly. You know, so it's, you know, it's sort of, maybe I think too much about that and I worry about it too much, but that's sort of what's not made me want to go on. It kept me off Facebook as well, you know, that sort of, and also when I, you know, the media, the kind of social media world has changed very dramatically and considerably. And I think now everybody has a voice, you know, and that's great. You know, I love the fact that everybody has a voice. But before that, when I was writing articles, you know, and I might say something provocative, generally not deliberately. So I'm not one of those journalists who, you know, deliberately would write something provocative, but
you're not the Howard Stern of.
No, I'm not at all. But I, you know, in fact, one of the things I think I do is that I, you know, I'm just very honest about my taste and the things I like or don't like. But I think some people would see that, you know, almost as trolling, you know, if I'm saying something that I like, you know, they would think, well, how could you possibly like that? You know, or like those two things in tandem. And if you write it on a journalism, if you write an article for the, you know, most of the papers here now, they have the below the line comments, people get really irate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so angry. And you're just thinking like, well, you know, I'm glad that that's there so you can have your voice and say, you know, but I was just doing my job of reviewing that book. And the fact that you feel completely the opposite in quite a violent way, you know, that's fine if it's on the newspaper's website and it's all good. But if it's on your own, I don't know, Facebook page or whatever, you know, it's sort of, it feels a bit invasive, really, I guess. You know, it's kind of like, and I understand why people are annoyed. You know, I mean, I get annoyed if I read a review and it seems completely off the money, you know, I mean, but I don't really, I wouldn't really respond angrily to that. You know, I just,
Right. That seems real. Unless it's like a biopic of somebody that you love and they're like completely trashing it. Like, how could you say that about Boss Baby? And you're like, it wasn't that great. What do you want me to say?
No, absolutely. And especially now, I mean, in the climate now, you know, it's sort of, it's such a fervid time, you know, I mean, it really sort of, I mean,
which is good and bad. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, totally. I mean, and I think that's great. And I think protests are great. And I think, you know, different voices and diversity of opinion, you know, all of those things are fantastic and important. But there comes a point where you want to sort of stop and get on with writing or, you know, whatever the next thing is, you know, you can spend whole days sort of following it and realizing that you're not actually getting much done, you know?
Yeah. And that's one of the, I think almost every social media has that little rabbit hole that you can fall into. And I think, you know, like you said, with Prince fans, I think that's been one of the kind of cool things that I've seen about it is, you know, being able to see these people that have this footage that they probably have on VHS at their home that they're like playing and recording and putting out there. And that's kind of cool. And then seeing all the different responses that people have to it. And I've definitely made acquaintance with some very cool people based on that. And I think that that's great. And that you can do that in just about any field of interest or level of interest with different people around there. And, you know, you just kind of always hope that you don't run into a troll somewhere. And
yeah. Well, it's weird. I mean, I find it quite moving. I mean, I genuinely, you know, I've found people that, you know, and you think, well, either I really respect what you're saying and I think it's really interesting and it's a different take than mine and I'm, you know, and that's interesting. Or, you know, you're finding somebody who's got the same feelings about something that you thought that nobody had that, or that particular period, you know. But I think, you know, the sort of rules of entry for this kind of conversation is that, you know, that you're respecting other people's opinions and other people's takes on it, you know, and understanding that there will be kind of points of commonality and there will be, you know, points that are not, but you know, and I've never tried to set myself up as the world's authority on Prince. You know, it's just that, you know, I spent 7 years thinking about him every day and trying to talk to people and, you know, getting as much into it as I possibly could. And, you know, and there are other people that have done the same, you know, but I'm really interested in hearing other people's opinions. I'm not interested in people saying that person has a stupid opinion or that person shouldn't be allowed to speak or that person, you know, or you shouldn't have said that or your book's not as good as somebody else's book or whatever, you know, it's sort of, it doesn't really go, you know, that's fine. You know, I mean, I feel very proud of the work I put into that book. And I think that, you know, I think it's of value, you know, I think it's a worthwhile thing to have done. Otherwise I wouldn't have done it, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Well, I can't thank you enough for all of the time.
No problem at all.
I know it's very late there.
No, you say it's a bit late. It's just gone 1 o'clock, but I'm a night owl, so it's fine.
Well, we covered a lot. I'm going to give you an opportunity to do anything for your books. I mean, should people basically just look up Matt Thorne in Amazon?
Yeah, that's the best. Yeah. I mean, if you enjoyed listening to what I said, I think the two books of mine that are the best books that most writers will say, you know, you can read any of them or, you know, or, you know, they're all great or whatever. But I'm very aware, I think, that I've written, of the six novels I've written, I think two really work. One was 8 Minutes Idle. And I think, you know, you can either read the book or watch the film. You know, I think they're very different. They're massively different. The novel is a 500 page novel with lots of different narrative strands. The film is a 90 minute comedy, which takes one of those strands. But I think that's worthwhile. And then I wrote another novel called Cherry, which was long listed for the Man Booker Prize over here, which is the big literary award. And that's probably the book of mine that was most acclaimed. And those are the two where I think it worked. And I think it's partly because it was the period of my life where everything, you know, you can really want to write a good novel and everything in your life just isn't allowing you to do that. And then sometimes, you know, everything just goes right. And those are the two, I think, where everything just went right for me.
And what was that app? How do you spell thing that you were talking about that coincides with
High? So this is a new thing. It's an app. It's not spelt as you might imagine, as it's spelt O-O-H. OOLIPO. So it's Oulipo, but with two O's rather than O U. So OOLIPO. You can download that from iTunes, and it's on iPhone. I don't think it's on Android yet, but an Android version is coming. And then if you download that, there's some other novels there as well. And mine is called High. And at the moment, the first chapter is up there, and you can read that for free. And then I think round about mid-April, the other 9 chapters will appear, and you can buy them. An in-app purchase is not very expensive. But that's the next thing.
I literally just downloaded the app.
So it was successful, right?
On an iPhone, I will specify. Great. So, and also, you can, again, find Matt on Twitter at 8 Minutes Idle.
Yep.
Just with the number up at the front. Sincerely, thank you so much. This was awesome.
No problem. I really enjoyed it. It was good fun. I had a very good evening.
Yeah, likewise. And truly, you are living my British life. So,
well, you're living in LA, so that, you know, that trumps everything, I think.
Well, I don't know about that. I would trade places with you. And thank you so much, Matt. I had a great time recording with you.
No problem. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. And there it is, the end of the second episode of myself speaking with the fantabulous Matt Thorne from England. Matt Thorne, again, you can find him at 8 Minutes Idle, that's the number 8, on Twitter, and you can find all of his books and such on Amazon. Matt Thorne, it's with an E at the end. Make sure you check that out. Matt, again, what a tremendous experience having this conversation with you. I genuinely appreciate your generosity of your time on a weekend night so late on your side of the world to have that conversation with me, to be able to share it with all of these fantastic people. I hope you all got a lot out of that. I really enjoyed this conversation. So if you want to leave me a note and let me know what you thought about it, you can send me an email at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. Again, make sure that you check out the website. There is some extra writings and some photos there at www.daddyunscripted.com that pertain to this episode. So you can look at those while you are listening to the other episode. If you didn't already listen to it, shame on you. Our episode that normally would follow this episode, I kind of did it in the reverse fashion because of the content and because of it falling so rightfully in time with the anniversary of the death of Prince. So you can check that out. That is the episode before this one with myself and Matt. You can find everything for Daddy Unscripted on social media as Daddy Unscripted. What do you know? You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. You can also drop me a line at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. Let me know some other guests you would like me to have a conversation with. I keep getting some fantastic ideas for other guests, and the way that this road has kind of gone throughout the course of this year is really exciting to me and is really starting to pick up some steam from the audience. So I really appreciate you guys giving some input. Keep that up. Again, you can send that to daddyunscripted@gmail.com. I want to also thank Umphreys McGee for the use of their music in all of the Daddy Unscripted podcast episodes. And specifically, I will assure you, all music in this podcast episode is by Umphreys McGee. So anything you're hearing in the background and during the intro and outro, that is all Umphreys McGee, and so good. So thanks again to that band for being so gracious in letting me use their music in the podcast. And stay tuned for the next episode. I have my gear all over the place for special remote guests in different part of the country, so I can't really tell you who that will be, but keep your eye out for the next episode. Thanks a lot, you guys.